come on a journey with a cinephile.
Wake up, sucker. We're thieves and we're bad guys. That's exactly what we are.
Welcome, listeners, to episode 231 of Journey with a Cinephile, a horror movie podcast. As always, I'm your tour guide here of David Garrett Jr., recording out of Columbus, Ohio. So in this episode here for you is going to be my first actual foray through the fours. So that means that I've actually gotten out of, you know, all the 24 films. So I'm now starting with 1934. And the first one that I'm going to be watching here is Maniac. And then I'm going to be pairing this up with Exhuma. Doesn't make the greatest double feature here, but what I can say is that we have the human condition a bit here and how certain decisions we make can alter our lives forever. So then also on this episode here, I got mini reviews of Onibaba. Finally gave this classic a watch. I went to the Gateway Film Center to check out Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. Then I got to watch Let Sleeping Corpses Lie, a.k.a. The Living Dead at Manchester Morgue, which is my foray through the fours rewatch. Then I also checked out on Shudder the documentary Dario Argento, Paninico, or however you'd say that. And then I also got to watch a couple screeners here. The first one's a feature film of Protanopia, I think it's how you'd say that, and then a short film of Friends Forever. So I don't think there's anything else I need to get you up speed with here except getting over to do my
monthly review.
Now that we are in April, here's what everything that I watched for and some stats for the March of 2024. I watched 43 total films. I have 33 horror films, and 13 of those are new releases for this year, which is just crazy that I was able to watch that many. So then what I think I'm going to go ahead and do here is actually give you a bit of like how that stacks up. Is 13 is by far the most I've ever seen. I actually was looking through it. I don't know if outside of December and October I've ever watched double-digit new releases, but this month I've actually been able to do that with how many of them have been sent over to me directly. The closest I've ever done has been 7, which was 2022 and 2018. The lowest was 2021 at 3. So I've watched 47 horror films that are released in that specific year since keeping track. And then for horror films, this one's actually the most I've ever done in March, as I had 33. The next highest was last year at 28. And then the lowest I've ever done was 2018 at 22. I've watched 186 horror films in the months of March since I've been keeping track. And then this is the second highest I've ever watched for total. As 2019, I had 45. Of course, I had 43. And then the lowest I've ever done in any of these was 31, where I actually still made that goal, and that was 2021. I've watched 263 films in the months of March that I've been keeping track. And then my percentage of horror is 76.74%, which is on the higher end. The highest was 2020 at 81.82%. And then it looks like the lowest I've ever done was 2019 at 60%, and then my average across the board is 71.1% for horror being what I watched. So then all the horror movies that I watched in this March was Here for Blood, Bram Stoker's Dracula, Creature from the Black Lagoon, Waxworks, that is the one from the 20s, The Wendigo, The Skinwalkers, American Werewolves 2, that's a documentary, Leprechaun Returns, The Hunger, Leprechaun 6, Back to the Hood, The Addiction, Imaginary, Dead of Night, a.k.a. Death Dream, Another Evil, The Hills Have Eyes from 77, the OG, Fright Night 85, the OG, Dante's Inferno from 1924, Blood for Dracula, Easter Bloody Easter, Dr. Jekyll, Everwinter Night, Immaculate, The Crawlers, Late Night with the Devil, Ed Wood, Alita, the Queen of Mars, It's Alive, 7852, Dagger, Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire, Onibaba, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, Maniac, this is from 1934, and Exuma. So then, countries represented here, I have 11, which is United States, Canada, United Kingdom, Germany, Italy, France, Australia, United Arab Emirates, Soviet Union slash Russia, Japan, and South Korea. So then the 2024 watches that I have are Here for Blood, The Wendigo, The Skinwalkers, American Werewolves 2, Imaginary, Easter Bloody Easter, Dr. Jekyll, Everwinter Night, Immaculate, Late Night with the Devil, Dagger, Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, and Exuma. So the oldest watches I have are going to be Waxworks, Dante's Inferno, and Alita, the Queen of Mars, are all from 1924. And then let me go ahead and do the average year thing here, and that is going to be, I guess, is 1993, which is actually on, this is the, like, earliest I've ever had here. The closest one to this would have been 2020, right, 1994, and then the highest I've ever had was 2019 at 2002. My average year for the months of March is going to be a 1997. And then the highest rated I have is Creature from the Black Lagoon. That was a 9.5. And then on this was I have my on this episode, I have my lowest, which is a 4. The average rating is a 7.4, which is, like, right there. It's on the higher end. The highest I've ever done was 2019 at 7.6. And then 2018, I had 7.5. The lowest I've ever done was 2022 at a 7.0. So then, not on this feed, I actually have Ed Wood, which is a bonus episode, which is actually Journey with a Cinephile Presents Depth Dive, a deeper look at Johnny's feature filmography with my wife. And then I also have Leprechaun Returns. That was over on SideQuest Podcast, which I did with Jake. So then looking at my yearly totals, we, to be on pace for just actually doing like the average, if you do it by like 12 months and everything, for 2024 watches, I should be at 24.9. I'm at 25, so I'm ahead of the curve there. Horror films, I should be at 91.2, but I'm at 97, so I'm ahead of the curve there. What is actually kind of crazy, my quest for 500, I should have 125.1. I'm at 124, so I'm just behind there. Average year, the normal average is actually 1998. My average year for this year, though, right now is 1993. And then average rating is a 7. That's actually bringing my average down, which is usually a 7.4 across the board. And percentage of horror, I'm actually just under that. It's normally 79.43%. I'm at 78.23% here for 2024. So then my most watched country that's not the United States is the UK at 14 films, then France at 13, Canada 8, and then we have a tie between Italy, Germany, and Spain at 6, then I have Australia and South Korea at 5, and then Belgium at 3. Top language, it's not English. I have no spoken language as I've been watching some silent films at 6. And then I have Korean at 5, Spanish at 4, which is tied with Italian at 4. And then we have Japanese and French at 2. And then tied between at 1 film is Swedish, Portuguese, and German. Highest rated country is South Korea at 4.25, Germany at 3.83, UK at 3.71, Italy at 3.67, USA at 3.62, Canada at 3.5, Australia at 3.38, France at 3.23, and then Spain at 2.5. Highest rated language is Korean at 4.25, no spoken language at 3.88, English at 3.51, and Spanish at 3.25. So then looking at my themes and nano genres, the most I've seen is creepy, chilling, and terrifying at 9 films, and that's tied with bloody vampire horror at 9 films, which makes sense due to what was being shown at the Gateway Film Center with their vampire series. And then I have gothic and eerie haunting horror at 7, chilling experiments and classic monsters at 5, and then tied at 3 we have horror of the undead and monster classics with sci-fi monsters and dinosaur adventures, gory, gruesome, and slasher, sci-fi horror creatures and aliens, and then lastly survival horror and zombie carnage all at 3, as I was saying. And then tied at 2 to end this out here is going to be monsters, aliens, sci-fi, and the apocalypse with dangerous technology and the apocalypse. Nano genres, the most that I've seen here are vampires, gruesome and frightening at 11, then horror, vampires, dark at 10, scary, cool, graphic at 9, which is tied with gruesome, dark, and imaginative. Then we have a few of these tied at 8 with scary, bloody attacks, creepy, bloody fear, gory, cool, evil, graphic, supernatural, Dracula, and horror, violence, nudity. And then lastly is going to be creepy, monster, Dracula at 7 films. So then themes, the highest rated I have are sci-fi, monster, dinosaur, adventures at 4.83. Then we have sci-fi, horror, creatures, and aliens at 4.5. Horror, the undead, and monster classic is tied with creepy, chilling, terrifying at 4.33. Then we have bloody vampire horror at 4.28. Gothic and eerie haunting horror at 4.21. Then there is Gory, Gruesome, and Slasher Horror at 4. Chilling Experiments and Classic Monsters 3.9. And then Survival Horror and Zombie Carnage at 3.83. And then Nano Genres, the highest rated, is Creature Mystery Discovery is at 4.83. And this is going to be tied with Monster Ship Scientific, as well as Giant Scientific Attacks, Creature Destruction Earth, Terror Mystery Discovery, Frightened Twist Climax, Funny Attacking Campy, Terror Attacks Screaming, Giant Beast 1950s, and Planet Scientist 1950s. All of those are at 4.83. So then moving to my most seen actor, of course, is Johnny Depp due to that podcast I've already revealed. And then Antonio Mayans is second with 5. Tied for 3rd is Boris Karloff and John Carradine with 4. Then we have tied for 5th is Craig Hill, Jack Taylor, Joe Dyok-jen, William Dafoe, and Dan Hedaya at 3 films. And then all tied for 10th with 2 films are Ron Perlman, Keith Knight, James Swanton, Noah Taylor, James Gammon, Dora Dahl, Gu Yong Wen, Han Chul Wu, Lena Romay, Fernando Rey, Daniel Katz, Daniel Grimm, Timothy J. Cox, Choi Min-suk, Bill Murray, Kumail Nanjiani, Ben Wright, Vincent D'Onofrio, Song Kang-ho, Choi Jung-ru, Joe Mooney, Christopher Kirby, and Udo Kier. And then for my most seen directors, it's still Jesus Franco at 5, Guillermo del Toro at 3, and then tied for 3rd is going to be Andrea Bianchi, Ford Beebe, Kai Roach-Turner, and Tim Burton, all at 2 films. And then I'm also going to say here for the themes and nano genres, I'm actually going to give my yearly ones at 6 months as well, just to kind of see if anything changes when I do my end of year, because I do want to start incorporating that just a bit more. So I don't think there's anything else I need to do here then for this intro or this monthly review, so let me get you over then to a brief break before I get into those mini reviews, and I hope you enjoy coming on this journey with me. And for my first mini review here is going to be Oni Baba from 1964. This was written and directed by Kenito Shindo. This stars Nobuko Atua, Jitsuka Yoshimura, and Kai Sato. This is a drama horror thriller film that is from Japan. It is currently sitting on a 7.9 on IMDb and a 4.1 on Letterboxd, with our synopsis being: two women kill samurai and sell their belongings for a living. While one of them is having an affair with their neighbor, the other woman meets a mysterious samurai wearing a bizarre mask. So this is one that I didn't learn about until delving deeper into the classics. The title popped up first when I was reading through the Fangoria Top 300 Horror Movie issue. It is also listed on Letterboxd Top Horror Films, which went on a list of ones for me to see as well. It was the next highest. That was a blind spot for me. So where I want to start is that this is taking place in medieval Japan. I'm taking it that guns weren't used. We're seeing swords, halberds, and weapons like that. There isn't much in the way of communication. So I'd also be curious if there was, would the mother in this one have access to it, or even would Kaichi be able to respond? So I guess I should delve a little bit deeper here, is we have Kichi, who we never actually meet. Now, his mother is portrayed by Atua, and then his wife is portrayed by Yashimura. Now, they live together, and they're the two that are hunting and killing people, and then he went off to war with Hachi, portrayed by Sato, and he returns here, and he's the one that the now widow is having an affair with. Now, the state of Japan has left these peasants with nothing. The weather wasn't good, so it doesn't help either, so their crops died. We're seeing this group do what they must to survive. Now, even though it's a simple story, that's not to say there isn't interesting ideas within it. The mother and wife are living together because Kaichi went off to war. I'm guessing that if he hadn't, he would be helping take care of his mother as well as, you know, help with his wife. Now, since the crops failed, they decided to become bandits to survive, using the tall vegetation and knowledge of the area to their advantage. They're getting by. Hachi shows up and complicates things. The mother doesn't trust him. I get the idea that the widow doesn't either. Now, there's also this idea that he may have killed Kaichi. That's not proven. He is a scoundrel, though. That turns on the widower, which makes the mother worry that she's going to be left alone to fend for herself. Hachi doesn't truly love her. He's lonely and wants just to make love to her. He's even willing to work together with the mother. Now, she gets greedy, which is, I get why, as she doesn't want to share, as there's not a lot of food to go around, and I don't fault her for what she does there. Now, this causes her to be punished, and she should also let her daughter-in-law decide to do what for herself and not make that decision for her. Another story element that I want to discuss is the idea of a curse. The samurai general shows up wearing this demon mask. I originally thought it was going to turn out to be her son. When she removes this mask, we see that there's something wrong with his face. This makes sense later to what happens. Like I said, the mother decides to use her influence on the daughter-in-law, and this results in her being cursed with this mask. It is interesting to where it ends up, and I like that. It is even incorporated in like folklore into the framework. Now, what makes this work, though, is the acting. Ottawa, Yashimura, and Sato carry this. We get a baseline of life for the first two. Now, they're getting by, and life is hard. Hachi then becomes a temptation for the daughter-in-law. He also could ruin the routine that the mother has set up. We see how decisions here change them all forever. Uno is also good in his limited role. Should say he is Jukachi Uno, who plays the samurai general. And then we also have Taji Tanoyama portraying Ushi. Now, this is the guy that they actually exchange weapons and armor for food. Other than that, we have soldiers and people that we are seeing at Ushi's place. They fit what was needed. All that's left in is filmmaking. This is excellently made. First, there's the setting. Being that they live in these tall reeds, it's disorienting. We know that they're isolated, but that adds to it. There also allows them to hunt the fleeing soldiers with an advantage. Cinematography here is beautiful to capture all this. There is rain and wind that makes it feel eerie at times. That isolation is also felt through the framing, which I appreciated. I should also bring up that there's this hole that is used. It is said in the beginning that it's been there since the beginning of time. Other than that, we have some limited effects that are used. Doesn't need them, though, either. This is more about the atmosphere, which I'll say the soundtrack helps. This is another strong aspect. So, in conclusion, I'm glad that I finally seen this movie. It wasn't exactly what I was expecting. I've seen the poster and it sticks with you. This is a simple story with complicated elements underneath it. I do love the idea of this familial obligations versus survival. The acting here brings the characters to life, with credit to Ottawa and Yoshimura leading the way. Sato is good as the temptation. There's an expert class in filmmaking, from the cinematography, framing, and soundtrack to build the necessary atmosphere. I'd say that this won't be for everybody. This is an art house film. I'd recommend this if you're out to see the classics in the genre. Be warned, this is from Japan, so I had to watch it with subtitles on. There isn't a lot of dialogue, so keep that in mind as well. So my rating, after this first time with Onibaba, is going to be a 9 out of 10. And then for my second mini review here, I actually got to go to the Gateway Film Center to finally watch Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. This is from 2024, directed by Gil Keanu. Now, they also wrote this with Jason Reitman, and this is based on the original film that was written by Ivan Reitman, Dan Aykroyd, and Harold Ramis. This is starring Paul Rudd, Carrie Coon, and Finn Wolfhard. There's a lot of people in this one, though. There's a lot of bringing back some older characters and whatnot. But this is an adventure, comedy, fantasy, sci-fi, officially on IMDb. I consider it to be horror enough just because of some of the elements. This is a co-production of the United States, Canada, United Kingdom. Currently sitting on a 6.5 on IMDb and a 2.7 on Letterboxd, with a synopsis being, when the discovery of an ancient artifact unleashes an evil force, Ghostbusters new and old must join forces to protect their home as well as to save the world from a second ice age. So this one, I'll be honest, wasn't a priority to see. I ended up checking it out during the day on a Saturday when I had some free time. Don't get me wrong, I love the original. The second one I have nostalgia for, and Afterlife hit me in the feels. This isn't one that I was avoiding, just not rushing to see it. So what I will say is, this is a fun movie. It is also funny is that I saw someone say that if Afterlife is the original, then this is part two. What I took that to mean is that the OG captured lightning in a bottle. It was a great feel-good movie with effects and just worked. Afterlife has great heart and bounces back from the All-Woman remake, which I don't even hate that one, as a heads up. This one here just feels like it's going grander. It is just missing something to fully work. So let's get into positives, though. I like what they built on with the, like what they started with the original one. So we still have that whole family being back here of Callie Spangler, portrayed by Coon. Now, she was struggling and needing to move into her father's house to figure out her life. She now has a purpose as a Ghostbuster, but it isn't something that's guaranteed, since we actually have, we're bringing back, what is his name here? Walter Peck, who is now the mayor in New York City, portrayed once again by William Atherton. Now, her life and what she was providing for her children isn't free from stress still. I like that she's with Gary Gruberman, portrayed by Rudd, and they make a cute couple. We also focus here on Phoebe, the daughter, being portrayed by McKenna Grace, as her being too young to be a Ghostbuster due to like child labor laws, which makes sense in the grand scheme. I need to also shift to a negative. I saw someone say that there's just too many characters, and I can understand, I don't fully agree, but what makes an issue, though, is we have the Trevor character, once again, played by Wolfhard. He has no arc outside of being an 18-year-old and wanting to be seen as an adult. They also bring back Lucky, who's portrayed by Celeste O'Connor. We see there is attraction still, but it goes nowhere. This is more of a focus on Phoebe and potentially exploring her sexuality here. She gets close to a ghost as Melody, portrayed by Emily Ellen Lind, and could be hinting that this young woman is gay. That takes a back seat, though, for obvious reasons. So I don't have an issue that I like what they do with Winston, as he is Winston Zeddemore, portrayed by Ernie Hudson, of course. Now, he's the money guy behind the team. Ray Stantz creates issues by taking Phoebe and the character of Podcast to see a colleague. Ray, of course, is Aykroyd, and then Podcast is portrayed by Logan Kim. We also get to meet Dr. Hubert Vartsky, portrayed by Patton Oswalt. That was good to fill in backstory for this new villain, and it makes sense how Nadim fits into the story going forward from there. He is portrayed by Najani, and that would be Kumail Najani. We even get a bit here of Peter Venkman, portrayed by Bill Murray, of course, and Janine Melnitz, portrayed by Annie Potts. I thought those were fine. There are a bunch of side characters that needed to push things to where it ends up. So I'll talk then for the story's the new villain. This is where it feels like it's trying to go grander, like Ghostbusters 2. I don't find Viggo in that movie to be grander than Gozer from the original. If memory serves, his latter villain makes an appearance there as well. So this monster is doing what you have to be on par with demigods. The Earth mythology that we get about how it could freeze the world and what was done in the past to defeat it. There are even references to people like the Ghostbusters being in the past helping. I dug that parallel. Now, that should be enough for the story. Let's go over to the filmmaking. This is a CGI fest, and it has a good budget for that. We have, like, the mini Stave Puff Marshmallow guys are adorable. The new ghost is terrifying. If they could incorporate more practically done effects, that would make this better. I get why they don't, so I digress. Thought the action scenes were good, so credit to the cinematography and framing. No issues there. It does hide the seams. Oh, not the soundtrack fit for what was needed. So let's end out with acting. No one is going to win awards here, but this is a fun movie. Rudd makes me laugh, and it's another solid performance for him. This feels like he's done so well in other movies like Ant-Man. Coon is good as his hardened mother of the teens. It feels real, and she's good at what she does. Wolfhard is fine in his role. Gray shows more range with the characters since she gets to explore it more there. Najani, Oswalt, I'd also say James Acaster and Lind were good additions. I like bringing back O'Connor and Kim. It's fun to see Murray, Aykroyd, Hudson, Potts, and Arthurton. Now, the acting here was fine for what was needed. The ghosts and the action are what's really kind of the focal. Now, in conclusion, this is a fun follow-up. I don't think this lived up to what the original or even Afterlife did. That's not to say it's bad. I thought this was built on some good things. Bringing back classic characters while continuing to develop the new ones was good. There's just too many, though, with not enough runtime. This is still well-made. If you didn't know, this is a CGI fest and has the budget to look good. It is a popcorn film, so come in with that knowledge. There's a heart underneath this, and I enjoyed my time and would rewatch this for sure. So my rating for Ghostbusters Frozen Empire is going to be a 7 out of 10. And my next mini review here is going to be my foray through the fours rewatch of Let Sleeping Corpses Lie, aka The Living Dead at Manchester Morgue. Now this also has a couple of original titles like No Profanar el Suano de las Muertos, or you can also go by Nancy Devi Profanar el Suano de Morti. Don't know which is which. So this is from 74, directed by Jorge Grau, and then this was written between Sandro Cantinzena, Marcelo Corsia, while also some uncredited work here by Juan Cabos and Miguel Rubio. This stars Christina Galbo, Ray Lovelock, and Arthur Kennedy. This is a horror film that is a co-production between Spain and Italy, currently sitting on a 6.8 on IMDb and a 3.4 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being, a cop chases two hippies suspected of a series of Manson-like murders. Unbeknownst to him, the real culprits are the living dead brought to life with a thirst for human flesh by ultrasonic radiation used for pest control. So this is a film I got turned on to thanks to the podcast Under the Stairs Summer Challenge Series. This came up as one of the 10 best from 74, so it went on my list to check out. Now, I've given this a second one, as I said here, for my foray through the fours, and I just kind of wanted to give this one a rewatch. So I love the underlying theme here of protecting the environment and how experiments can hurt the ecological base balance of the Earth. That ends up being the way these dead come back. It is crazy this film came out in 74, and we are still dealing with issues like this 50-plus years later. I am a firm believer in science, but there must be testing to ensure things don't hurt the environment, but I'll get off my soapbox. So another positive aspect, it doesn't waste time to get into it. We end up seeing George Meaning, portrayed by Lovelock, as he leaves London to head up to the countryside, and then has a chance encounter with Edna Simmons, portrayed by Galbo, and they get kind of stuck up this way. And then we also have that the first zombie that we see here of Guthrie, portrayed by Fernando Hilbeck, starts to attack. And then from there, we get long stretches without them as they fill in backstory, but this frustrated me the first time I saw it, but I don't really feel that way now. The zombies are good, so that helps. These aren't traditional ones, though. I think this is a bit of the trappings we would see with, like, Lucio Fulci's Gates of Hell trilogy, in that the zombies don't follow their own rules. As there are more of them, they do, but I don't buy Guthrie not going after those early on when they appear. There are also issues with a car is traveling one place, but Guthrie seems to teleport there, as this doesn't ruin the movie, but observations I have both times. The setting was something else I needed to touch on as well. I thought it looked amazing with the hills and the isolated countryside, plus we're in a smaller village. That does allow people to not know, like the police, that there are zombies. Everyone also moves on after the attack, so they're seeing the aftermath. That was a good touch since this is the beginning of the attacks. Let's discuss zombies. They do have super strength, which can be inconsistent. I did love that we get like a Night of the Living Dead scene of the zombies eating people just in color. It looked quite real, as did the rest of the effects. They were practical, which I loved, and it showed this in the film. The zombies also moved good, so credit to them. I like how they were slow moving. I do have to point out that we're almost running in one of the hospital scenes, which is another inconsistency. Now, let's go over this. Like, there's not much more to go into the story, so let's go over the acting. I thought it was solid. Galba works as our female lead. I didn't like that she gets bossed around like she does for a good portion. I do think this is partially due to times and how it's written. She also wrecked George's bike. She does show good fear, though. Lovelock was solid as her counterpart, even though he is a real jerk. I do like that he does embody that hero as the film progresses. His worrying about the environment is also a plus. Kennedy is also quite hard, but adds an interesting dynamic. I should say he's Arthur Kennedy there. He believes what's real and what can be seen. He thinks that Gelbo and Lovelock are criminals and will do nothing to like stop proving that. It also doesn't ruin anything, though, either. Now, the performance is fit for what was needed from the cast. There are just some odd characters at work. All that's left in is filmmaking. Something that was great here is the effects. I like that upon Martin, who is Jose Lifante's death, we hear all of his bones in his midsection being broken. And we see that they do this so they can eat what's inside, of course. Now, credit to the sound design for that as well. Finally, the soundtrack doesn't necessarily stand out to me, but it's good as the design. I do know they have this like radio at one point that is talking about ecological problems due to chemicals and experiments. Thought it was an interesting way to introduce that angle, as well as getting George's feelings on it. There's also a noise that is being emitted from this machine that results in radiation that's also good. So in conclusion, I enjoyed this the first time around, and it held up with a rewatch. Thought the ecological angle was interesting and something that is so relevant today. Having an isolated location is good. I'd say that this is well made, which helps. The zombies are the best part with their look and how they move, even though there are some inconsistencies with their abilities. The effects and cinematography are also solid. So the gore was as well. I like the sound design. I'd recommend this if you want a solid foreign zombie film. So my rating here for The Living Dead at Manchester Morgue, a.k.a. Sleeping Corpses Lie, is going to be a 7.5 out of 10. And up next, I watched a documentary of Dario Argento, Panico. This was directed by Simone Scafidi. This is from 2023, but it's getting its wide release here this year. But the story is done by Scafidi as well as Giada Manzolinelli. And then we also have the screenplay done by Manlio Gormarasca, Davide Lucia and Scafidi. If I'm mispronouncing those names, I do apologize in any of them going forward here, but this features Dario Argento, Asia Argento, and Fiora Argento. This is a documentary biography horror that is a co-production of Italy and United Kingdom. Currently sitting on a 6.7 on IMDb and a 3.3 on Letterboxd, with a synopsis being a film crew documents horror director Argento as he works on his latest script in a hotel room, revisiting the isolation where he dreamed up his most iconic films, removed from distractions to explore his dark imagination. So I saw this was on Shudder earlier this year. So I'm a huge fan of Argento, so getting a documentary about his personal life as well as his career was something I knew I'd have to watch. I started this one at work when my day was slow and then finished it at home. This moves fast, so like I would actually be up for one that's a little bit more slowed down and gets a bit more detail, but what we get here is great. But we get his personal life, becoming a filmmaker, and then goes through kind of what was happening in his like around him as these movies came out. So I knew parts of Argento's personal life. I tend to do research on people and things that I'm a fan of. I didn't know that he was married to a Marisa Casala. Earlier in life, they divorced as he became more popular to the point where elements of Four Flies on Grey Velvet might be mirroring things there. I knew that he had two daughters that were actors. That'd be Asia and Fioria. I didn't realize that he had a third. So this factors into things that were made with trauma, and it made things odd as well for him and Asia. So it's also interesting to hear from her about what happened between the love of his life and her mother, Daria Nicolodi. It is a shame that she passed away before this was made, as I would have loved to hear from her. It seems like Suspiria and Inferno stem from stories that Daria's mother told her. Daria wasn't a big fan on giving her more credit for some reason, and it strained their relationship. So that'd be something I'd like to see explored a bit more. These are things fans of this horror maestro already knew, but we're getting a different perspective. Now, something I liked here as well is that Daria was getting interviewed. These were done for this documentary as he is now older. We also get interviews from his, like, sister, Florina, his ex-wife, fellow filmmakers he's worked with, like Michele Sove, Lamberto Bava, Franco Farini, Luigi Cozzi, Claudio Simonetti, and Vittorio Cecchi Gori. There were some great filmmakers who directly influenced by him, like Guillermo del Toro, Gaspar Noé, and Carlos Wendin Refn. I also didn't want to leave out here that they talked to Christina Mercelic, who was the star of Opera. I'd also say this is well made. There's some great editing early where Dario is being driven to this remote hotel, and there are scenes from Deep Red and Suspiria edited in that made me smile. The only thing that I didn't necessarily like was that at different times, it felt like they were kind of making a movie and not a documentary. This doesn't ruin it by any stretch, but asking Dario and all these people different things, as well as framing what was going on in his life while making these different movies, was an interesting watch for fans of this filmmaker. I'd recommend this one for sure. So my rating here for Dario Argento, Panico, is going to be an 8 out of 10. Then I got a screener sent over to me of Protanopia. This is from here in 2024. It was written and directed by Matthew Mahler. It was starring Timothy J. Cox, Anthony Carey, and Mahler. This is a drama horror film that's from the United States, currently sitting on actually not enough ratings yet on IMDb, and the same for Letterboxd, but I would say between like a 3.5 and a 4-star movie over there. So the synopsis is a surreal horror film about greed and masculinity in American suburbia. So this is one that I got the chance to see thanks to the star of Cox, as he sent over a screener. Seeing that this was released in 2024 and in horror, I knew that I was going to check this out. Part of it is that I strive to have a well-rounded look at the year, so checking out independent film like this that I'd otherwise not know about helps. I came into this one knowing as little as possible as well because of that. So this is a difficult film to talk about. I'm not fully sure I understood everything that I saw. This does interesting things with the visuals and sound design that I appreciated. I found myself getting lost in it, and it gave me an unnerving feel that I'll credit. I don't think this is the deepest story, and I'm not sure if I necessarily need it, though. Now that I've truly lived in the suburb, this made me uncomfortable as well. So I should say is that this all starts when a young lady of Mallory, portrayed by James Chase, disappears. So her brother, Luke, portrayed by Carey, is the prime suspect, and we also see some weird things happening with Alan Rusco Jr., portrayed by Cox. So filmmaking is where I actually want to dive first, though, since this is an important thing here. I knew from the opening scene with Mallory and then the credits that this is going to be our house. The synopsis even braces you for that. The distortion of images with colors or slowing down the footage where it blurs was interesting. I loved it. It feels like the filmmaker was inspired by Mario Bava or Dario Argento with the use here. I also credit the cinematography to capture these visuals. That surreal feel also helps to build an eerie atmosphere. The sound design and music selections worked there as well. All of that was just solid. Let me get over to the story then. I don't mind what we have here. We set the stage that something odd is here. Mallory disappears and this turns the police onto this area. Alan sees his dead father in his living room, and it seems like Alan Sr., portrayed by John Mahler, needs him to do something. What I like here is that there could be something supernatural, or maybe Alan Jr. has just lost touch with reality due to his grief. He hears something in the basement that needs to either be fed or must appease. There's also this character of Jack, portrayed by Matthew Mahler. He tells Luke to do things. He also tells him that Mallory is fine and she'll turn up. It is something along those lines, at least. This person we get to see, but never fully. It would be part of their face while they're lying down. The framing there was well done. Jack has correlation with Alan and that house that I found interesting. Where this ends up was something I wasn't expecting. I also like that it has commentary on the area where they live and how behind closed doors we don't know what is happening. So what I think helps here is the acting. I'm not going to say that it's great. It fits what is needed with the characters and not asking them to do too much. I'm not just saying this since Cox sent me the screener, but he was good. I like that he seems to be holding on to his sanity by a thread, and someone like the character of Janice is trying his patience. She's portrayed by Paula Mahler. We get glimpses behind that curtain, which is eerie for Alan. Now, Carrie was good as Luke. I think we need a bit more fleshed out for him to work better. Matthew Mahler was good as this individual that we hear about, and it's kind of ominous what we know. I like Paula Mahler as Janice. She feels like this woman that I've met who runs little groups like this. We also have John Heerlin, who is the detective. Chase was good as and has an interesting musical number that fits a surreal vibe. Other than that, I thought the rest of the cast worked for what was needed. So in conclusion, this is a solid little film. We don't get the deepest story, but what we do flows well. This is more about the visuals. There is a surreal art house vibe here that made me uncomfortable in the best way possible. The acting fit what was needed for the character. I hate to say this, though, but it won't be for everybody. I do think there is an audience out there and will appreciate what is being done with the cinematography, editing, lighting, and sound design for sure. So my rating here for Protanopia, if that's how you say that, is going to be a 6.5 out of 10. I actually believe this is doing its festival rounds here, but keep an eye out for this if you see it streaming somewhere, if what I said sounds good. Then I have a short here to cover, A Friends Forever. This was directed by Thomas Angeletti, who also co-wrote this with Jared Richard Ocker and Paige Hoover. This stars Ashley Lawhorn, Colleen O'Morrow, and Mark Murtha. This is a horror film from the United States. Now, there's not enough ratings yet on IMDb and on Letterboxd. It looks like it's hovering between a 3.5 and a 4-star movie over there. And the synopsis, on a fall day in October 1987, a group of college friends find an abandoned house and throw a party they'll never forget. So this is a short that I got the chance to see thanks to, once again, Timothy J. Cox. He appears in the cold open. Since I like to support independent horror cinema, I agreed to check this out as a short for review. Other than that, I came to this one blind. So, our cold open is from 1957. There's a family of farmers. The father is portrayed by Cox. His wife is Julie Carney. They have two children of Kevin Reif and Christy Carson. Tragedy strikes when the father goes to pick an ear of corn and it's rotten. He brings it in to show mother. She goes upstairs, puts on white gloves, and kills her family with a knife. She places them around the table and puts on music. We then shift to the present in 1987. That's where we meet Cassandra, portrayed by Lawhorn, Erica, portrayed by O'Morrow, Ryan, portrayed by Murtha, and Lisa, portrayed by Hoover. They come to this house, which is oddly still has items set up from the past. It makes sense in the end. Erica didn't go away to college, so now that everyone's home, she wants to throw a party from the synopsis. Something doesn't feel right here, though, to Cass, but they all agree. That is what should be a great time, then, is a nightmare. So that's going to leave my recap and introduction to the characters. Where I want to start is that probably what I've given is about half the short, maybe just under that. But I thought it was set up nicely. We get a cold open, we then meet our group in 87, and then there's the party. I'll give credit here. We got enough extras that it feels real. I've seen movies with bigger budgets that try to do this, and it doesn't work out as well, so I wanted to give credit there. Now, for shorts, I tend to judge them if they tell a complete story or if I think they need to be fleshed out to more. I think that this one is one of the former. We know the tragedy struck in the 50s. It isn't explained why the mother snaps and kills her family. Since the corn is rotten, my guess is that she could have been afraid that they would have starved due to a bad harvest. My other thought is that the toxin that comes from the rotting corn made her go crazy. My only issue there is we need more prolonged exposure if memory serves. Now, seeing what we got in the opening, I wasn't sure if this was going to be a haunting or not. There are elements of that. What I'm going to say is that it does shift to another subgenre. I don't want to spoil that, though. There is a good reason for the motives with certain characters. Also, the past is influencing it as well. I do have to say that there is a questionable decision that I needed just a bit more for. In my opinion, the short needed a couple plot aspects. So give that a minute or two extra, and it tells a complete story. It isn't ruined but without having them, though. Just something I would prefer. So let's go over to the acting, then. I like Lawhorn as our lead, who knows that something is wrong but can't figure out what it is. The house that for the party is uncomfortable. It's also during the party that she notices something. I like O'Morrow and where her character ends up. She is interesting. Growth that I didn't expect. Murtha and Hoover were good as the two that round out that group. I also think that Carney, Cox, Reif, and Carson feel like this family from the past. Then the other thing here would be the attendees of the party were distinct and worked for what was needed. All that's left then is filmmaking. Thought the cinematography was good. The past is in black and white with the present in color. I thought that was a good touch. I also thought how they were framed were good. No issues there. I also like the fact that they went practical with all the effects they could. If there is any CGI there, I did notice it, so credit to them. Other than that, I thought the soundtrack and design were good. I did like that they have this old Victrola playing music, as it gives a eerie vibe that helped build the atmosphere. So in conclusion, this is a solid short film. I think that this tells a complete story, which can be hard to do for a short. I do think that it's missing a couple of story elements that would have helped. They're not necessarily needed, though. I thought the actors fit for what was needed. Special credit to Lawhorn and Omaro. And I thought that this was well made, from the cinematography to the effects and the old-time song used. I'd recommend this short if you want to see a haunting of sorts, just use it a different way. Just keep in mind this isn't working with a large budget, but to be honest, I don't think it necessarily needed it, though, either. So my rating here for Friends Forever is going to be a 7 out of 10. This one I also believe is doing its festival rounds, so I would also keep an eye out to wherever you watch short films to, you know, give this one a watch if you come across it, if you liked what you hear. That's all I have for mini reviews here, so let me go ahead and get you over to the trailer of my first featured review.
I tell you, working on the dead, trying to bring back life. It's not natural. You with your weird idea. Haven't I stayed here and nursed Diane's dogs? Yeah. And even that miserable cat?
Agony! I can't stand this torture! Stealing through my body, creeping through my veins, pouring in my blood, oh, darts of fire in my brain.
My first featured review here is going to be from 1934, the first one I'm actually doing as a feature review of Maniac. This is directed by Duane Esper. It was written by Hildegard Standy. This stars Bill Woods, Horace B. Carpenter, and Ted Edwards, while also featuring Phyllis Diller. Not the one you'd think. I actually thought the same thing. Thea Ramsey, Jenny Dark, Marvell Andre, Cecilia McCann, John P. Wade, Marion Constance Blackton, Umberto Garachasino, Bartholomew Pagano, and Satan as Satan the Cat. This is a horror sci-fi film that is from the United States. It is currently sitting on a 3.7 on IMDb and a 2.4 on Letterboxd for a synopsis. A former vaudevillian gifted at impersonation aids a mad scientist in reanimating corpses and soon goes mad himself. So this movie, that the poster stuck out to me before seeing the movie. I'll be honest, I was excited. That was until settling in to watch this movie. Seeing the rating and the runtime made me pause. It is fitting while settling in to write the review, though, that I noticed that Standy wrote this and that Esper directed it, as I did see another movie of theirs, Narcotic. So let me get over to the featured notes then, since I've already kind of delved into that a bit, and I'll start with our director of Esper. He has brought up previously with the film Narcotic. This feels similar. He has done 8 features and 3 shorts. He has one other one in genre with Sex Madness from 1938. There's an assistant director here of J. Stewart Blackton Jr. This is their only credit. Our writer is Standy, who has 6 features and 1 short. She also worked with Esper on Narcotics, I've Been Sane. No other ones in genre. Moving to the cast, I'll start with Woods, who has 3 films. I've only ever seen this one, only one he's done in genre. His co-star, though, of Carpenter, has been in 149 films and 6 shorts. His most famous is Gone with the Wind, which is my mom's favorite movie of all time, I believe. I've seen his second, which I think is Hitchcock's Foreign Correspondent. Now, I know that's the movie he was in. I'm not fully sure if that's Hitchcock's movie or not. Now, did 3 in horror, with this one being the only one that I've seen. He was also in Return of the Ape Man, which is on my list. Now, he's also in The Ghost Breaker from 1914. Then last will be Edwards. He was in 5 movies and 17 shorts. I've only ever seen this one, only one that he has done in horror as well. So this is a hard film to talk about. There are intercuts here of title cards, which is harkening back to the silent films, that are talking about different ailments of the mind. The former vaudeville actor is Maxwell, portrayed by Woods, who is working for Dr. Meerschaerts, portrayed by Carpenter. He has this actor pose as a morgue attendant so they can find a body. They're looking to bring somebody back to life, and they needed to be, like, not dead all that long, so this is almost like a Frankenstein story. Now, they find a woman who died by suicide with carbon monoxide. A serum is injected into her, and they seal the body. I actually think it's probably adrenaline they're using with something that happens later. Maxwell gets mad at his employer and shoots him. He decides to dress up as the doctor. Before he can hide the body, Mrs. Buckley, portrayed by Diller, shows up with her husband. Now, he's played by Edwards. He isn't feeling well, so Maxwell, posing as a doctor, is going to give him a shot. He means to give him water, which would actually hurt him as well, but instead gives him a shot of adrenaline. This drives him mad to the point where he steals a woman they brought back from the dead. I believe that he rapes her while they're out of the house. We then see Maxwell trying to hide the doctor by bricking him up in a chimney in the basement. Maxwell has visions that are taken from archive footage and overlaid. I take it that this is to show that he's losing grips with reality. He also has, like, dreams of grandeur. We also see that Maxwell is married to Alice, portrayed by Ramsey. She lives with 2 other women of Maisie, portrayed by Dark, and Marvel, portrayed by Andra. A man comes around looking for Maxwell. There's also an odd neighbor who raises cats for their hides. So what I'm going to say is this is a wild movie. I had to reference my notes as it was a couple days after watching it that I could, you know, write my review. It is one of those films where I know I watched it. Since I can't remember things, it made me question myself. The true answer here is that this doesn't have a coherent narrative. It plays partially like a PSA as we cut over these title cards regularly to kind of transition between scenes, and it's an explanation of different mental disorders every time we come back. I take it this was supposed to correlate with what we were seeing after them. It's just a bit too ambitious for these filmmakers. Now that that's out of the way, it doesn't shock me to learn that Standy wrote this and that Esper is the director. The other movie that I saw plays out very similarly. That one had more of a coherent narrative, but also had just random scenes that were thrown together as well. That one at least had a through line about that doctor or whatever who is a snake oil salesman who's supposed to be her relative and how he gets hooked on drugs a couple different times. So she seemed to enjoy making these cautionary tales against drug use. This one doesn't use it as much, but the adrenaline brings back the deceased woman. It also drives Buckley insane. This is more about the dangers of mental illness and how it can lead to criminal behavior. What they're presenting is socially relevant still. It just doesn't work as well as they would have liked for how all over the place this is. What doesn't help either is the acting is stiff or feels amateur. I thought that Woods was good as our vaudeville guy. We see him as he demanded to become the morgue attendant. He then changes and acts like Dr. Meerschaerts. That was good. He was the bright spot. Carpenter isn't bad either. The problem there is that they don't focus on him too long, or what they do actually when he's dead, and someone can only stay still for so long. He also doesn't have a big part in this. There's some minor movements that I noticed is what I was kind of getting at with that previous thing. That falls on filmmakers. Edwards is funny when he goes mad and attacks a woman that was stolen from the morgue. I'd say that Diller, Ramsey, Dark, Andre, and the rest of the cast were solid. No one is good, don't get me wrong, but also shout out to the neighbor who's raising cats and using rats to feed them. He's wild in what he tells the police. All that's left before some trivia is filmmaking. That is hindered by the budget when it comes to the editing. They're putting in filler with the title cards. I get what they're doing. I don't know if what is on screen shows that enough. I'll give credit to overlaying images from the adventure movies to just show how wild Maxwell's thoughts are. Other than that, the cinematography is fine. Doesn't do much to stand out. There isn't other effects used that I could tell. The soundtrack was also fine. Didn't stand out or hurt this for me. I did like what they did with the design, though, with the cat in the basement. That feels like it's borrowing from Edgar Allan Poe. So then, the trivia on the IMDb page, several cast members in this were uncredited and their identities remain unknown, most notably the cat farmer Goof, as well as the detective, the skinny morgue attendant, and Maria Altura, the woman who Dr. Meerschaltz brings back to life. The identity of the actress who doubles for her for the scenes that requires nudity also has not been identified. Author and historian Brent Wood has argued that the backyard cat farm was real and an illegal operation in someone's backyard in a Los Angeles suburb. He also suggests that the morgue was found or rented rather than a set built by the filmmakers. A few of the intertitles comment on the action in the film as they were used in silent films. Part of them describe various mental illnesses like dementia praecox, now called schizophrenia, paresis, which is neurosyphilis, paranoid, which is paranoia, manic depressive, psychosis, which is bipolar disorder, and manias. Because Don Maxwell doesn't know how to put the syringe, he puts it in water, saying that it could not be harmful. Injecting water into a vein, however, would cause red blood cells to rupture, which could, depending on the type and the amount of water, could be very harmful. Blackton is sometimes reported incorrectly as appearing in male drag as a neighbor who catches and breeds cats. She plays a female neighbor who is questioned by the detective. I think she's actually the one who directs that detective to the cat farmer. The first Esper film to feature female frontal nudity. According to the screenwriter and producing partner Standy, the team never had trouble finding actresses who are willing to be nude on camera. This is listed among the 100 most amusingly bad movies ever made in Golden Raspberry Award founder John Wilson's book, The Official Razzies Movie Guide. And there's also some trivia here about an effect that was done with a cat, which I didn't actually remember that going down, but that actually makes sense what they did there, and it doesn't actually harm the cat. So in conclusion, this isn't a good movie. It is trying to do things, but that don't flesh out well enough. It also feels like the budget is holding back as well. I will give credit to being ahead of its time in exploring mental illness in cinema. This is still socially relevant today, especially when discussing criminals. The acting has moments of being solid. There are decent aspects of the filmmaking, not one that I can recommend to everybody, unless you are interested in the history of cinema and want to see an early PSA scare film. So my rating here for Maniac 1934 is going to be a 4 out of 10. Also, not going to do a spoiler section. If you couldn't tell, I don't necessarily need to do that, so let me get you over to the trailer of my second featured review.
저게 사람 감 나죠?
관에서 뭐가 나왔다고 이 사람아!
뭐가 나왔다고 거기서 겁나 험한 게.
And for my second featured review here is going to be Exuma. This goes by the original title of Pamyo. This is from 2024. It is written and directed by Jae Hoan Jang, and this stars Kim Go Eun, Choi Min Suk, and Lee Do Hoon, while also featuring Yoo Hae-jin, Hong Seon-joon, Kim Jae-cheo, and Jeon Chin-kai. This is a horror mystery thriller film that is from South Korea, currently sitting on a 7.4 on IMDb and a 3.6 on Letterboxd with our synopsis. The process of excavating an ominous grave unleashes dreadful consequences buried underneath. So this is one that I saw the poster at the Gateway Film Center. Then they were showing the trailer on the televisions above the ticket center while I was waiting, so I ended up looking like into it a bit and saw that it was a 2024 horror film. So I went on a list of ones to check out, decided to make it a feature review since I tend to enjoy films from South Korea, so I was going to gamble that this one would make a better feature review than some of the other things that were streaming. So let's do some feature notes then. I'll start with our director of Jae Hoan, has helmed 3 features and 1 short, has 2 now in genre, with the other one being Savaha, The Sixth Finger. I've not seen that one. Now, there are 2 assistant directors here. First is Kwon Ji-yu, He has done this role on 4 films, only one that I've seen in genre, and also in genre, that is. The other is Kim Jong-hoo. They've worked on 6 movies. I've only ever seen this one. Bringing back Jae Hwan, you know, our director, he's written 4 films and 1 short. He has the same 2 that he directed and also has wrote The House of the Disappeared from 2017, which is in genre. Let's go to the cast. First is Min Suk, who has been in 37 films and 2 shorts. I've seen him in Old Boy and I Saw the Devil. They're not always considered to be horror, but they are both bleak. Now, he also has one other one in genre of The Quiet Family from 1998 that is in horror. His co-star of Go Eun has been in 18 films. I've only ever seen this. This is the only one that she's done in horror. I'll also look at Do Hwan. Has 9 features, 2 shorts. This is the only one that I've seen and the only one that is in horror as well. So let's get to the synopsis. Let me flesh out this story here. We have a lot of moving parts here. There is a duo that are shaman who are Hwarim, portrayed by Go Eun, and Bong Gil, portrayed by Du Huang. Now, we see them doing a cleansing to start out. It then takes us over to a geomancer portrayed by, or he is Kim Sang-deok, portrayed by Min Suk. Now, he works with Ko Young-gun, portrayed by Hya Jin. And if I mispronounce these names, I do apologize. I'm trying my best here. What is important to note here, though, is that they work for with a rich family to find the best plots to get their loved ones into the afterlife. Kim is the best at what he does, but he makes a comment later that it also is a scam. So, there's a rich family that need help. Part of them live in the United States, one of which is the president of a company named Kim, portrayed by Seo Joon. He has a newborn son, and there is something wrong, but the doctors can't figure out why. This leads them to seek out the aid of the shaman. What they learn is that they have an ancestor who they believe is coming after the baby. Now, the ancestor is buried on a plot of land that is overlooking the border of South and North Korea. Kim and Ko are called in, with the former thinking it's odd. Now, the family doesn't want to reveal too many details. It turns out their ancestor in question was a Japanese sympathizer. He was working with someone from Japan during World War II, and a monk at a nearby temple was the reason this plot was selected. It was a bit of a punishment. It seems the monk was also a geomancer. Dark secrets need to be revealed before it is too late. There could also be a darker, more evil spirit at work here. So that's only my recap and introduction to the characters. Where I want to start is that I wrote this review days after seeing this. I'll play my hand a bit in saying that I want to watch this again before doing my end of year list. This one has vibes of The Wailing for me. I'll get into why, and I'm not saying it's as good. They're just story elements and atmosphere. Now that I've gotten those opening thoughts out here, let me go deeper. I compare this to The Wailing because it's a modern world while having pagan beliefs. There are also elements of Christianity as well, so we're seeing how these differ. This family that is plagued in the beginning has moved to the United States. I get the idea they've converted to Christianity, at least the younger members of the family. There is a grandmother who remembers this ancestor who haunted them when he was alive. Now, she still seems to cling to the beliefs of the past, not fully though, because she pushes back against Hwarim, Bong, and Kim, and I can't fault her. Looking at things logically, it makes sense. When there is a child at risk, I would fall into beliefs that I don't currently hold for help if everything is failing around me. As a newer parent myself, I'd do whatever I needed to protect them. Just an idea I need to explore here, as I like the aspect of this movie. And getting back to the original thought, we also have the shaman and geomancer needing to do pagan rituals to defeat the evil spirit. What I love here is that this goes back to The Wailing, and we don't know if it'll help or not. They are in over their head and try to do what they know has worked in the past, and I love that. Going against something that is stronger than you helps to build the atmosphere here. There's also the idea of other cultures coming into places against Korean. Like Japanese at the time, the ancestor died, were the enemy, the spirit still holds this idea. I love the look of it, and I'll come back to that. We also have the U.S. looming with the modern belief system as well. Now, something I want to say here is I'm not going to spoil this movie, but I need to watch it again to do that as well. Because like, there's some things I'm sure that I just kind of, being in the theater and everything, that I might have missed, but this doesn't have the deepest story. It is more about revealing hidden secrets with the main story, and when we get that, it's one of those things where like you're into the frying pan, like out of the fire type thing, where you go from one thing that gets revealed to the next, and I love that. Kim, Hwarim, and Bong help to find clues, and that leads to more evidence they need. I do like stories structured like that, so that helps. Shifting from this, I'll say the acting helps here. I believe these characters who are they're supposed to be. Go Eun is attractive, and I like her as this female shaman. She works well off of Du Hwan. there is something interesting here where he is hospitalized, so she needs to do what she can to save him. I also like seeing Min Suk. He's an actor that I've seen in a couple of roles that I've said earlier, and he's great in everything I've seen so far. I like Hae Jin as his sidekick. He doesn't seem to believe as much, as he's more worried about what'll hurt or help them financially. Other than that, the rest of the cast fit for what was needed. Special credit to the voice of the Japanese spirit, as that was terrifying. All that's left then is filmmaking and some trivia, where I'll start then is cinematography. I love how they capture the different locations we were at. It could be a small town, like small time morgue in a village. There's the temple where a terrifying encounter goes down. We get glimpses of a hospital room in the U.S. The best though is this remote gravesite where things go down. I love how they capture this, so credit to the framing. Then I'll talk about the effects. They are limited, but I like what we got. I thought that was good. There is blood that looks real. Other than that, I thought the soundtrack fit for what was needed. I'll bring up again the sound design as it comes to the voices, Japanese ghosts, which is creepy. All this helps to build the atmosphere that is needed. So then, let me go over to do a little bit of trivia on the IMDb page. According to the director, the actor studied real rituals from shamans in order to accurately portray them in the film. I like that. The leading actress, Go In, who starred as Harem, a shaman, said in an interview that she was a bit worried about being obsessed or other supernatural things she might experience. This was because she did everything she did in the scene, like praying, exorcism, for example, as exactly the same as real shamans do. But a real shaman who assisted on production talked to her and said she doesn't need to concern herself with such things. One more thing, the director is a Christian himself, serving as a deacon for the local church, so that explains kind of the duality thing there. According to the director, some of the names here are patriotic martyrs of South Korea who fought against the Japanese colonial rule. And then numbers on plates of main characters' cars are related to South Koreans' independence movement. So if you know a little bit more, that's some like fun fact, little things that you can reveal there. So in conclusion, this is a movie that I'm not hearing about. I'm guessing it's due to its limited theatrical run. I'm hoping this hits a streaming service so I can rewatch this and the word spreads. I'm a fan of the premise here. This is, you know, being pagan versus religion, traditional versus modern, and having the elements of a haunting. It also being Korean helps here. I thought this was well made from the cinematography, framing, the look of the spirits, and the sound design. The acting also helps to bring the characters to life. This won't be for everybody, but if what I said sounds good to you, I recommend giving this one a watch. So after one viewing in the theater, I gave Eczema an 8 out of 10. And like I said, I need to revisit this for my end of year list. So I'm not going to do a spoiler section or anything like that. So let me get you over to one last break before I close out the show.
Journey with a Cinephile.
And welcome back one last time here. And just to kind of go through my social medias and stuff, if you'd like to send me an email, you can send that at journeywithacinephile@gmail.com. You can send me any sort of feedback, or if you have any questions or anything, go ahead and shoot them there, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Or if you want to send me any screener links or anything like that, anything podcast-related, you can send it via that way. If you'd like to read any of the written reviews, I'll direct you to Reviews of the Dead, and that's horrorreview.webnode.com. If you'd like to become friends with me on Facebook, I'm David Michigan Garrett Jr. On Twitter, I'm Buckeye from Mish. Letterboxd, I'm David OSU. On Instagram, I'm DavidOSU87. On Threads, I'm DavidOSU87. And then Journey with a Cinephile has its own Instagram at Journey with a Cinephile, all one word. Now, all of these ones I will be sharing, like, my ratings on, whatnot. I know for Letterboxd, all of the reviews are going to be for horror and non-horror alike. Instagram, I will be sharing over there is my different, like, posters and everything for things that I'm reviewing. My personal account, you might see some personal pictures every now and then if I can remember to take them. And then, you know, kind of same thing for Threads. And then Journey with a Cinephile is going to be more of just kind of posting podcast-related different stuff over there. And I'll also direct you to the Nightclub Discord channel, as I have a little section over there where we have some good conversations. I post all of my reviews and any new podcast episodes or some of the things I'm watching when I actually have time to post that. So keep an eye out over there, and I'll have the link for that and everything else in the show notes there. And then I'm also going to direct you, if a way that you can actually listen to the show is going to be through the Pod Nation TV. This is a streaming service and everything like that. There will be a link in the blog posts for all of my episodes, so if you'd like to listen to it that way. It's kind of a cool little thing. You can definitely do that through like Roku TV, and there's some other apps for it as well. Just as another way for you to consume this podcast if you decide to. There's also a lot of other great shows that are on that network as well. And for my next episode, we're going to continue with doing these foray through the fours, as the next one from 1934 is going to be The Phantom of the Convent, which is actually quite interesting, as I'm going to be pairing this up with The First Omen. I'm going to go to the Gateway Film Center some point this weekend to check this movie out. Then my foray through the fours rewatch is going to be Deranged. Now, I do have another screener. I'm not sure if it's going to be this week or next week that I'll watch that, but regardless, I will have some mini reviews for you of some other stuff that I've watched. Don't think there's anything else I necessarily need to go into then for here, because there wasn't anything else shown at the Gateway Film Center that I was going to check out from what I could tell either. So what I will say in closing is, whatever you do today, hope you're safe and doing it, have a great time out there. This is your tour guide of David Garrett Jr., and I am signing off.
It had been a wonderful evening, and what I needed now to give it the perfect ending.